This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 51st in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Anoop Ghosh. Hi, Anoop.
Hi, Gary.
Anoop Ghosh is a recognized internet security expert, the author of 3 books on e-commerce security, and founder and chief scientist of Invincia. Dr. Ghosh served as a program manager at DARPA in the Advanced Technology Office. He's authored over 40 peer-reviewed articles and serves on the editorial board of IEEE S&P Magazine. Long ago, Dr. Ghosh was Vice President of Research at Cigital Labs, and among his numerous awards are the Frank Rallet Trophy for Individual Contribution for his research in quarantining computer-based worms, and the IEEE Millennium Medal for Outstanding Contributions to E-commerce Security. Anoop has a PhD in EE from the University of Virginia and a BS in EE from WPI. He lives in Virginia with his wife, Neetha, and son, Jay. Thanks for joining us today, Anoop.
Well, thank you. That's a terrific introduction. I appreciate that. And I'm really excited to be on Silver Bullet.
So you've moved from startup when you and I worked together at Cigital back when it was called RST to government research and then back to startup mode. So
yeah.
What's more fun?
No doubt startup mode. Now, DARPA is an unusual place. It is in the government, but it's not so unlike running a startup. You get a really broad degree of latitude to be entrepreneurial, and that's really what's expected of you as a program manager at DARPA.
Mm-hmm. So you get the same kind of bubbling of ideas, but a lot more people and a bureaucracy to boot.
Not really. DARPA is a really, really lean organization.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's got about 90 or so program managers and maybe, 110 employees or so. Yeah, I think the official number is like 120 or something.
Uh-huh.
But so there's not a lot of bureaucracy. I mean, at least when I was there, it was you and the director. The director held the budget. As you said, a lot of the job of a program manager is to bubble up ideas, both within the program manager's head and also within the community. And then you put together a plan. You sell the idea to the director. You can think of the director as sort of a venture capitalist, although that's not really what they do. But if you can sell your idea, he can or she can give you significant funds to solve a problem.
So
that's pretty exciting.
I guess you're about 10 times smaller now with Invincia that has, 13 people or so?
Yeah.
And growing like a weed, you probably doubled since last I talked to you.
Yeah, we're on that growth trajectory right now.
So what's the biggest challenge you face as a company sort of running a startup?
Yeah, so what I've noticed, and this isn't unlike the early days at Cigital, is you get pulled in lots of different directions by potential customers, right? And the question is, everything, it's like being in a candy store, right? Everything looks great, and you want to go solve that problem for that customer and this other one for this other customer. And so I think the biggest challenge, especially in the startup mode, is staying focused and really going to market with the product that you believe in and that you vetted to some extent by the market, while not getting diffused by all the different demands that people would love you to go down these different roads.
Yeah, stick into your knitting, so to speak.
Yeah, thank you.
So you've served both as a principal investigator on grants, and you had grants from the NSA and DARPA and NIST's ATP program, and also as a program manager at DARPA, which you mentioned before. What role, in your view, with both of those hats on at the same time, does scientific research play in computer security as a field?
Well, it needs to play a large role. In fact, I would argue that it needs to play a much larger role than what it currently is doing. So back you know, in the late 90s when we were doing, you know, some great research at Sigil around software security, we were changing the field. I truly believe the type of research we were doing and the research that was done at that time around intrusion detection, for example, ultimately did change that field. A lot of it was funded by DARPA, and a lot of it went to companies. A lot of it went to universities that open sourced their work. And ultimately, the ideas and sometimes the code ended up in commercial products in the marketplace that ultimately were sold back to the government and the companies, of course. During the early 2000s, there was a period where a lot of the government-funded research in information security got classified.
Uh-huh.
And it had an unbelievable impact, in my opinion, on innovation in the commercial market.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that explicitly, because I know that DARPA does a lot of classified work, and you probably did some when you were there. And I really worry a lot about science and how you might do science that's classified. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I can appreciate that point of view. Certainly, I've been on both sides of this issue. I've been on the commercial side when I was doing commercial research that was unclassified. I was on, on the academic side at George Mason University,
mm-hmm.
where we do unclassified research, of course.
Yep.
And then on the government side, running a whole bunch of classified programs. And I share your concern. I think there's a role for classified research. And it has to do with, doesn't have a lot to do with defending your network, is what I should say.
Well, right. Yep.
And, a lot of times what classification will do is hide brittleness.
Yep.
And it's used, to hide brittleness in techniques. And I think it encourages the wrong mindset when you're developing defenses and secure defenses. I'm a big believer in that peer review can separate good work from bad work.
Mm-hmm.
And having people review your work and find flaws in it is only going to improve it.
It's kind of like turning on the lights in the kitchen in the middle of the night and watching the cockroaches.
Scurry. Yeah. Yeah. And so
I'm not sure if peer review is the cockroaches or the light. Probably the light.
So I find it, at least in terms of developing information security technologies, classifying that work is more likely to discourage good, high-quality, peer-reviewed work. Number one, you're not going to get some of the key players who are the bright stars in the field to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, you don't have, the peer-review system where papers can be published and reviewed.
Right.
And, flawed work can be found and then improved. And then more importantly, the work never makes it out into the commercial market.
Yep.
And that's a travesty of it all, is you might have, and I do believe there were, really good technologies developed in classified programs that never, ever see the light of day because the government, as it turns out, actually buys all of its IT off the shelf, commercial.
Right.
And unless there's a path to go from, good government-funded research to the market, there's no way the government ever benefits from that.
Well, the research all ends up in that big giant warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Exactly. I'm a little bit outspoken on that topic and, probably speaking a little out of school.
I thought you'd have interesting thoughts about it, having been on both sides of the fence, and we appreciate hearing what you have to say.
Yep.
So your current work focuses on advanced malware, such as, say, the Zeus malware. Can you explain what an advanced persistent threat or APT is, using Zeus as an example?
Yeah, actually the term is kind of used loosely, and as a result, it's beginning to be slightly controversial in the sense that some people say, by definition, if it's advanced persistent threat, you cannot detect it. because that's what makes it advanced. So
that's like AI work, you know, it's AI until it works, and then it's no longer AI, it's just normal engineering.
Exactly. So I'm going to brush aside, you know, that camp and just speak more to the threat. So Zeus is fairly interesting, and I would say, in fact, a game changer. So I was at RSA about 2 years ago, which is our industry, security industry conference, the big one. And at that time, you know, kind of coming from Washington and coming from the national security establishment, I was frankly shocked at the lack of recognition in both the commercial world and especially in the banking world as to the extent of the threat that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was out there again this year. We obviously met up, and I saw a sea change in both the commercial guys and the banking guys and in understanding this threat. And I think it was Zeus that really changed everything, at least for the bank.
Zeus and also the Google episode that got so much press.
Yeah. So Google put it on the map for the general public, but for the technology sector in particular, they began to realize, hey, I've actually got some valuable IP that other people actually care about and enough to break into my network. So talk about APTs for a second. So the basic concept of an APT is it's software whose goal in life is to get onto your system, evade any sort of detection mechanisms you may have, bury itself in your network, and then at that point it can be remotely commanded and controlled.
So what's the difference between an APT and a rootkit that is involved in botnetting?
Not a big difference at all. You know, what people would say the core difference is APTs sort of by definition don't get detected by your commercial off-the-shelf software.
Yeah, rootkits are not supposed to be either.
Yeah. But it's essentially the same thing. I mean, a rootkit is there to hide tracks of other malware that's downloaded. You know, let's talk about Zeus for a second. So Zeus is a Trojan that's really just pervasive now. And it's pervasive because it's got tremendous capability for an adversary who controls it to capture keystrokes, to be what's called a man-in-the-browser type of threat, which we can get back to, and to be able to schedule transactions online.
And it can even, because it's a man-in-the-browser or person-in-the-browser, defeat multi-factor authentication systems.
Yeah. Notice you're being politically correct there, as if code has gender.
All code is male.
So that's what's interesting about it. You know, we all of us who do online banking, which is probably most of us now, see these various mechanisms banks will deploy, right? So one of them are these tokens, these picture IDs that you're supposed to recognize. For whatever reason, mine always seem different. I don't know about you. I don't know what's up with that. Another one of these things are these hardware tokens. I actually have a hardware token from my bank. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'm if I do a wire transfer, I get asked to enter the one-time password that comes up on the hardware token.
Mm-hmm.
And this should give me, you know, a good feeling, right? Because I now know this is a one-time password that, you know, even if it's captured by a keystroke logger, it can't be reused. What Zeus and its ilk does now is they're just very clever, right? So you enter your one-time password. It knows you've entered your one-time password. It's so-called in the browser in the sense that it's watching what you're doing. Once you've authenticated with your one-time password, which, by the way, lasts about 2 minutes,
mm-hmm.
or maybe 90 seconds, it will actually at that point hold up the transaction that you scheduled, the wire transfer, and on its own schedule a wire transfer to the account of the bot master who controls it. So, you know, it's a very effective technique now for defeating almost all authentication techniques on the end platform.
So, you know, it seems obvious to me, but why doesn't antivirus work against that. And, you know, what are businesses supposed to do now that Zeus is out there?
So, you know, a lot of, again, there's been a sea change in the industry. 2 years ago, you know, people wouldn't openly say antivirus doesn't work anymore. Again, this past year, it's not even whispers. It's the panelists. It's the vendors themselves are admitting that antivirus doesn't work anymore. And the reason it doesn't work anymore is because of the explosion of malware. So antivirus works by detecting a threat it knows about. So the really easy way to detect malware is to send a threat that's unique. If it's unique, antivirus is not going to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that explains why you have, you know, 15 million new variants of malware in 1 year. And this, you know, logarithmic growth in malware. And so a lot of the infections you see today are called singletons because they're unique on the machines they infect. And if you're an enterprise business and a brand in particular, you will get infections that are custom written through a toolkit, so it's not that big of a deal, but custom written for your brand. And it will be targeted to you, and of course is not going to be in your antivirus database that you're running.
Mm-hmm. So to change the topic a little bit, for years we worked together with Brad Arkin, who now has the unenviable job of being a running point for security at Adobe. And it's pretty clear that attacks migrated from Microsoft to Adobe now, who's in the spotlight, probably because Microsoft started doing a better job, and both of those platforms are so widely available. Just, you know, everybody has a copy of Adobe Reader, just like everybody had a copy of the Microsoft operating system. But the real question is, who's next?
Oh, great question. Let me just spend a moment on Adobe. One of the interesting things about Adobe is they're on over 99% of all computers that are out there, right? So Microsoft's market share, maybe in the 90% range, you know, and of course it's being challenged by Mac. Adobe is everywhere, right?
So, except for the iPad.
Good point. Good point. And so, you know, if you're going to write an exploit and you want that exploit to get out there, you want the broadest possible market share.
Yep.
And so Adobe gives you tremendous access to a really wide range of platforms. So that's why it's a target. The other thing is something that you've talked about extensively, and it's this concept of being able to take software that one vendor produces and then extend its functionality, right? So you call it extensible software, and that's what's at play here. You take your browser, and you add in a third-party, we call it plugin, which is really just adding software to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then this plugin ends up running what? It ends up running someone else's code, right? So that it could be a Flash plugin, for instance, which we think about running videos or movies, but in fact, it's a combination of video content plus code.
Mm-hmm.
And so what an adversary needs to do is find a bug anywhere in that stack between the Flash player, the browser, and the system it runs on. And once it finds that vulnerability, any content you know that's out there can potentially exploit that vulnerability.
So coming back around to the question, who's next? Assuming Adobe, you know, gets their act together, which they seem to be doing, is there another very ubiquitous piece of software or, you know, part of the stack that you think is going to be the next target?
Well, it's an interesting question, and my thought is not so much who's next as much as what type of attacks will be next.
No, that's an interesting way to spin it.
And so, you know, if you think about the way we do security today, and let's talk about the enterprise for a moment. We have these you know, these perimeter defenses, you know, the castle moat defenses as you've called them, which are at the outside. And then on the desktop, you have your antivirus. And then in the enterprise, you have these compliance initiatives,
mm-hmm.
right? And the basic idea is if you keep all your software up to the latest and greatest patch level, then, you know, you should be fine. The types of attacks that we're now migrating to, you know, in the past they've been called social engineering attacks. I think maybe a nuance on that is attacks through trusted networks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the types of attacks, and by the way, these attacks, you know, sail right through your perimeter defenses, number one. Number two, they don't care if you have a fully patched system. And let me explain that. So if I send you an IM or if I send you a Facebook update, and if the subject of the IM or the Facebook update is, hey Gary, check out this video I recorded, or hey, will you take a look at this document for me and tell me, do you mind reviewing it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it comes from me and I'm in your trusted network, you're more than likely to click on that link. And let's take the example that it's a video. So when you click on that link, it'll open up in the browser. Your browser will open up, and it'll go to this website, and that website will have a video on it. But instead of playing, the first thing it tells you is, you know, your Flash player is out of date.
Right.
And so it'll ask you to update your Flash player.
So it still takes somebody to do the click.
In this case, yeah, it's about getting you to click, and it could be clicking on a link. It could be clicking through dialog boxes that the operating system presents you. But the point here is it's not very hard to get you to click on links and boxes
right.
on your operating system.
Right.
And when you do that, you will install the malware. And because the link came from me or someone in your trusted network, you're inclined to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And even besides that, you want to see the video. That's what I've seen, is these videos and these messages are very, very persuasive. They know how to appeal to human nature to get you to do it.
Well, you remember the thing that Ed and I wrote back in 1996 about given the choice between dancing pigs and security, the world will choose dancing pigs every time.
Absolutely, and that hasn't changed. And today, you know, it's more of, you know, the YouTube video of, you know, the latest sexy girl that really gets people to click on these links.
Right.
The other thing that's kind of all the rage that illustrates the same thing is what's called fake antivirus or rogue security software.
Mm-hmm.
And those are incredibly impressive. When you get them, what you will see is all of a sudden your browser somehow sort of disappears. And instead, what you see is your desktop and you see Windows telling you you're infected,
right.
that there are three or four infected files, and no problem because it's going to clean them up. Just click here. and the graphics, the UI is simply amazing.
It really is. And I the thing I find particularly interesting about that set of attacks is the way they change their domains and IP numbers to keep off the blacklist.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's fast domain name changing. I also find it interesting because there's a whole lot of information you can get about a user's operating system just from the client. And so they will read what operating system you're running. They will match the video to your Windows XP operating, for instance, or your Windows 7 operating system. And what's actually playing is a video. You don't realize it's actually a video.
Taking the full screen.
And it's just amazing because you're like, oh, my God, I just got infected. And it looks like Windows. Sometimes it'll look like an antivirus client you're running,
uh-huh.
and it asks you to click here to quarantine those files and remove them. And again, it's such a powerful message to a user. When you click here, that's when you get infected,
right.
and that's the amazing part. And
right.
it's just not very hard to get users to do. Now, if you had a patched system, guess what? It's not going to matter.
Right.
You will still infect yourself. If you had a firewall, it's not going to matter because you requested that link, so mm-hmm. it's going to let that happen. Right. So all of the standard defenses we have don't address this problem today. And I think that's the flavor of where attacks are moving to. You know, a pithy response is I think IM clients are going to be the next new vector. But on the other hand, everything is moving to the browser. So, for instance, I do all my email, I do all of my chat in the browser, and if I so chose, I could do my documents in the browser as well using Google Docs. So I actually think the browser will remain the primary infection vector for some time to come, just because there's so much functionality that's now being done in the browser, and now you have netbooks that pretty much run one application, a browser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because you can sort of see the browser as the ultimate thing, but there was an article in this month's issue of the Atlantic Monthly that declares the internet dead yet again. And talks about this idea of content migrating into apps in kind of a walled garden, you know, like the iPad app, the Amazon store app, mm-hmm. and so on, in the Facebook app. So I think it's not exactly clear what's going to happen in terms of, you know, what the ultimate platform will be. But the web browser is sure going to be play a major role for a long time.
Yeah, and you bring up another really important point, which is what's the relevance of the desktop in the future, right? So most of us now carry a small computer in our hands, and you know, we've been talking about the security of these devices for too long, right? To be credible anymore, because the threat hasn't emerged in a significant way. So you always risk, you know, losing credibility talking about this. But I think what has changed is you've got pretty full-featured operating systems now on these devices.
Convergence has occurred.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, my God. That's a word from, like, the 90s.
it took a while.
Yeah.
But now, you know, you carry around a PC in your pocket, basically.
And the other big deal there is, before, the content was controlled by the carrier, right? Now the content is being developed by millions of people in their bedrooms, right? And put up on sites like the app marketplace for Google.
Yeah, the Android marketplace. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, and of course the iTunes. So now that you have third-party code that's running on what I would consider a mission-critical device, how long is it before that really gets exploited in a big way?
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to
maybe that's my official answer to your question, is the next big app to be exploited is the one in your hand.
So I wanted to ask you about something completely different. You served as an advisor to Paul Perrone's robotics team. Which was pretty cool. What are those guys up to these days?
Yeah, so just to provide some background there. So Paul Perrone and his company, Perrone Robotics, put together a grand challenge entry in one of the DARPA grand challenges, the Urban Challenge. And I was an advisor just helping on, interfacing with the government in the competition. But those guys, really interesting project that Paul's working on now. He's working with Neil Young, no less the great rocker himself, on a car called Link Bolt. and it's just absolutely amazing. The guy, Neil Young, is extremely passionate about technology. He wants to be able to take, I don't know the year, but it's a really old Lincoln, uh-huh. You know, and defies all logic that this could possibly be green. And he wants to demonstrate through innovative technology that you can take a really old American car, a classic American car, and get tremendous fuel efficiency and automation.
Cool.
So Paul has a major role in that project, and he hangs out with Neil, which is pretty interesting.
I had no idea that question was going to go there.
I know.
And then another real quick flyer. So cyber war is all over the media these days. Mm-hmm. Is the threat exaggerated, and should we care?
Well, you know, there's obviously a hype machine behind it, which doesn't mean the threat's not there.
Right.
Cyber war, I think of war as having a defined end, beginning and defined end. There's clearly no defined beginning and end to cyber threats. I think what you're seeing in the media is a play for money. to get Congress to act. I tend to believe that you've got a camp that will over-exaggerate the threat to get a lot more money, mm-hmm. and then you've got a different camp who says, well, this is all, you know, bits and bytes. It can't really hurt someone, and I think they're both wrong.
Right.
everybody experiences cyber exploits, period. And for people who organizations that think they don't, they really just aren't paying close enough attention.
Mm-hmm.
On a national level, there are good reasons why another country would not take out our infrastructure, but not so much for a loner, right? So the real threat that we need to worry about is the asymmetric threat, which is if I can cobble together with a few thousand dollars worth of equipment a significant enough attack that would bring down the grid, well, then we've got a real problem on our hands. And arguably, it's possible. And as an industry, we need to do better.
Mm-hmm. And then the last question, which, as you know, is always a flyer. What is your favorite newspaper or magazine?
Oh, wow. So I actually do read The Washington Post quite a bit, and that's probably just a regional thing. In terms of magazines, I don't read a whole lot of magazines. I do read a lot of ebooks. It's my bedtime reading, and the last one I've been reading is Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. Before that, I read Outliers, which I thought was actually very, very good. yeah.
I always read the short versions of those books in The New Yorker.
Yeah,
just because I'm lazy, you know, they boil it down to 20 pages.
And you can. That's the interesting thing about them. It may not be. You might question it, right? But and that's where the book helps. I think it sort of explains it in more detail.
Well, thanks a lot, Anoop. It's been interesting.
It's been terrific. Thanks so much for having me on.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The May-June issue of IEEE S&P digs into risk assessment with an article about protection poker. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.